Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of The Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we talk about the currently streaking Oklahoma City Thunder coming off of a pair of big wins against Western Conference Titans. We talk about what we've liked from their recent play. We then check in on the most improved race. We talk about our philosophy surrounding the award and some names that we're thinking about early with a deeper dive coming later. We preview this upcoming unrivaled basketball slate, talk about the matchups and things that we're excited about. And then we are joined by the Hall of Famer, championship head coach, Becky Hammon of the Las Vegas Aces, where we have a deep, versatile conversation about all things hoops and a little bit of things about Becky. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for embracing your bounce, and I'm ready to talk some hoop.
Let's talk some hoop then, Steve. It's been a fun week of basketball. Honestly, we've had a lot of marquee matchups. I wanted to take this Friday, as we like to get deep divey on Fridays, I wanted to check in with the Oklahoma City Thunder. We did our tier list earlier in the week. We both still had them in the S tier, despite this weird like 12, 15 game stretch that they were on. We're not too far removed from me personally yelling at them about defending double drag poorly as they got blown out by the Charlotte Hornets. But since that Hornets loss, they've won five straight. That is the longest active winning streak in the league right now. It's three straight wins against playoff slash play-in teams. If you're looking at Miami, San Antonio, and Houston. And with the last two in particular, these are two Western Conference teams in the Spurs and the Rockets from the same division at that matter that are trying to earn their way into true contention status. And I have been impressed by what OKC has been able to do as of late, particularly with those two opponents. They weren't just wins, Steve. These were a pair of double-digit beatdowns, particularly in the second half of these games. It felt more like the Thunder that we got accustomed to earlier in the year. So before, I have lots of thoughts about what these last couple of games have been. But before we get there, you had them in the S tier, so I would assume no. But like, how concerned did you actually get during that weird stretch for OKC?
The thing is, I didn't. And so it was interesting because you've kind of been sprinkling a little bit of concern over the Thunder, like parsley. And I was just like, I think they're fine. Like, they're the top team in the league. They're 35-7, 20-2 at home, 15-4 on the road. There's no other team in the league with less than five road losses. You go to NBA.com, they're fifth in offensive rating, first in defensive rating. So when it was like, hey, let's talk Thunder, I'm like, what are we worried about? They're going to be just fine. And I think it kind of ties back into like the ethos of this team and how Mark Dadnault has built them to kind of adapt and move on and move forward throughout the year. And then I'll tell you who's been less concerned than me, Chet Holmgren, because yes. Every time he says that, it's like, hey, can you guys relax? Like, I think the quote from him post game that he was asked about bouncing back with this winning streak. And Chet said, when you lose, everyone acts like the ceiling is caving in and the sky is falling, or sell the team. I don't think anybody is saying that, but that's what it feels like. But the most important part was the end. You can't lose sight of who you are, what you do, and how to do those things. And I feel like that's been the key for Oklahoma City during this run. Like, Phoenix got them. Charlotte really got them. Utah almost got them. Memphis almost got them. And then we're back to business. And I think it just comes down to even the best teams, even the most known quantities, it comes down to navigating circumstances, the strength of the regular season, figuring out how to get back to what you're doing. I think that's what they showcased during the stretch.
I think that's one of the more fascinating, as you were talking about what Chet had to say, I think that's kind of been one of the more fascinating aspects of this Thunder team over the past few years. Like, they are all very like process driven. They're all relatively even keel. And it's, I want to say odd. I don't mean it in a negative sense, but like, it's odd for a core that is as young as it is still to have that level of maturity and even keelness. Like, you don't really feel them even when they do lose. It's not necessarily, O'Shea just jacked seven straight shots, he's pressing. Jalen just jacked seven straight shots, he's pressing. Or you don't really feel that. It's more they did not execute, or teams kind of got them and they got to clean some things up. And so, like, even as I was sprinkling in my concerns with parsley, like, I did want to make sure I noted, like, hey, I do still feel like this is the title favorite, etc. But I am starting to see some things that are making me raise my brow. And so it has been, for me, encouraging to see not only have they bounced back, because you mentioned, like, Utah almost got them, Memphis almost got them. You face better competition, and it's 12-point win against Miami. It's a 21-point win against San Antonio Spurs, their first win over the Spurs this season. And then a 20-point win over the Rockets, which I didn't get to watch that game live, got to watch that super early this morning. And, like, I'm watching the game, and I'm taking my notes and gathering things, and I'm just like, okay, I saw the box score. How does this end up being a 20-point game? We end the third quarter. Like, how did this end up being a 20-point game? And then the fourth quarter started, and I was like, oh.
So this is the thing, I'm glad you brought that up, that I've enjoyed about this particular three-game stretch. It's about problem solving. It's about figuring things out. Not every game was perfect for them. And it's a reminder, like, for OKC, it's not about perfection, but they are such a sustainable team. And to beat them, you have to sustain on both ends. You go back to that Miami game. Miami comes out on fire attacking OKC's defense. They're getting drive kicked. They're hitting threes. OKC hangs around. Defense rises up. Shea drops 16 in the third, and off they go. Against the Spurs, it's back and forth. It's tense. It's contentious. Huge third quarter. Off they go. Against Houston, first quarter, muddy, right? Then they score 34 points in the second. They shoot 51%. They're up 7. We're feeling good. No, third quarter, you're shooting 38%, buddy. Two-point game again. And then fourth quarter, defense turns up. Off they go. And so that's just kind of been like the flow for the Thunder. It's been fun to kind of watch them navigate the stretch.
Yeah, it's been a good time. I want to circle back on the Thunder-Spurs game in particular. I want to go there first. Because anytime you are 0-3 against an opponent, and as we both noted at this point across different platforms, you lost at home, you lost on the road, you lost at a neutral site. You just want to see, hey, like, did they need to, if they would have lost against the Spurs again, are they suddenly not title contenders anymore? Like, no, nobody should be in that case. But just from a pride standpoint, a mentality standpoint, like, if you're OKC, yeah, let's get one. Let's kind of put them back in their place. Let them know, like, congratulations on those. Like, we are still the top dogs. We still got some stuff. Now, no Devin Vassell for the Spurs. No Isaiah Hartenstein for the Thunder. No Lou Dort for the Thunder in that game as well. So, like, there are still some things where, like, I don't want to put hard stamps on things yet, these two. So we'll see if they end up meeting up in the playoffs later. But I was fascinated by the process on both ends of the floor for them. And so much of these matchups have been around the way Victor Wembanyama has been able to dictate terms. Defensively, walling off the rim, you can't get there. That kind of puts a hitch in OKC's half-court offense. Defensively, we are winning with all of the drives. And then there's also the Wemby portion. And as we now move into the middle of the floor, how much help can we send? Where can we send it? How quickly can we send it? The Spurs playing off of that. And so with the Thunder offense first, and this bounces off of the awesome breakdown that you did on our most recent episode of the Dunkers by Steve, about how the Spurs have been intentional about keeping Victor Wembanyama low on the floor. There's going to be a lot of off-ball communication. If you try to cut through, I'm not falling for it. If I am on the wing, I'm switching places with a teammate so I can stay low, and I want to be able to wall off the paint. The Thunder, it felt like, had more intention early on about, one, who we're going to have in that corner with Wemby. Early in that game, it was a lot of Jalen Williams. There were a couple of possessions where it was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You had some Cason Wallace mixed in there as well. I think San Antonio would be okay with that, even though Cason can knock down corner threes. But it's like, okay, this is interesting. They are starting to, they're trying to tap these buttons a little bit, to Steve's point. And then we get a little bit later in the first quarter, and you start to see some of these drives. And it reminded me of the Christmas Day matchup, where early on in that game, okay, these drives from OKC, a little bit more volume. They're getting a little bit deeper in the paint. They're actually challenging Wemby. The problem in that Christmas Day matchup is that it did not sustain past the first quarter. And OKC was back in the mid-range 3 points. Those weren't falling. We're going to drive. There's Wemby. I'm not even looking at the rim anymore. We're going to keep it going that way. They were able to sustain a little bit more in this game overall. But as you got into some of those drives, like, I remember there was one pick and roll on the left side of the floor. Immediate attack. Wemby drops down. I'm going to protect the paint. And then here's a cut from the white wing from Jalen Williams. And he gets a basket. I'm just like, oh, I like that. I like that they're starting to mix in more of these cuts. And even on one of the earlier possessions from there, like, there was, I think, Cason Wallace in the corner. Wemby helps down. Cason cuts, comes back out. They exchange on the weak side. It's him and Jalen Williams. It ends up being a kick out to Jalen to Cason Wallace for one of the corner threes they made in that game. And I was like, okay, there's a little bit more intention from OKC's attack here. I love the way that this is starting to look. And you zoom out from that game, Steve, and I was looking at the previous Thunder-Spurs matchups.
Mm-hmm.
In the first matchup, 10% of OKC shots came in the restricted area when Wemby was on the floor. Woefully low number. In the second matchup, that was down to 5.3%. Woefully low number. In the Christmas Day matchup, that was 10%. A little bit better, but still woefully low. 25% of their shots came in the restricted area in this most recent matchup. And like that's still a little bit low compared to where they want to be with all the drivers and attackers that they have. But the fact that they were intentional about how they wanted to move Wimby and they got that number basically almost tripled their rate from the last matchup was very encouraging to me.
Understood. And I guess part of my question would be, how do we feel about Oklahoma City's drives as a whole? Because we've kind of seen this offense shape shift over the course of the year and being able to run more pick and roll, being able to execute different things, guard screens, going second side. At times, do you feel like sometimes it's too quick shot territory? It's too reliant on the drives to break things down? Because there are times against Houston where it's like, hey, we have the personnel to keep this ball in front, and then we have the personnel to stay at home. And so it's hard to sustain because OKC is committed to driving. But how do you feel about that balance when they are kind of in the half court, trying to kind of early in the clock, where it's like, okay, we don't have Isaiah Hardenstein, so it's not like we're going to automatically go to handoffs and pick and roll. We're going to try and get an advantage, get a matchup, drive and kick, get some cuts around it and play off that. How have you felt about that balance during that stretch? Because it's something that's been in my gut, but I don't necessarily know if it's an issue.
No, like I think that was what I was initially going to bring up. Like I wonder how much of this has been, we don't have Isaiah Hartenstein as kind of the traffic cop in the middle of possessions if we don't have something. Or with just him kicking things off above the break with handoffs and things. And so it has felt a little drive and kick reliant. I think that also speaks to, I guess, like an old thought for OKC. Like, hey, they probably could use another shooter or like a true movement shooter to where you have a little bit more variety. So it's not just drive and kick. It's not just pick and roll, which parlays into drive and kick. And it's not just the handoff stuff for Hartenstein, and now you don't have him. So that kind of puts a dent in that as well. Like, I do wonder if they get to a point, and it's not like they literally never do it, but I do wonder if they get to a point to where they start sprinkling in like some Shea elbow catches just to kind of add a little variety there. He won't be like, obviously him and Isaiah Hartenstein are totally different players, but like, do you get him some of those to try to manufacture some cutting around him? Or at the very least, you can't load up in the same way because now we have Shea in this spot. Like, it's not like he doesn't have the post game for it. So that's another thought bubble that I've had in relation to that. But yeah, like I think it's very much trying to figure out, we don't have Hartenstein. There are still players in our rotation, however good they are, that teams are comfortable helping off of. How can we counter this? Can we play a little bit faster so you don't have time to set up? And then can we introduce more of the cutting to kind of counter some of the help that you're showing? So like I'm with you that it's like kind of pop for me, but like a lot of this is they could probably use another shooter anyway. And Isaiah Hartenstein, he shouldn't be an underrated portion of the program at this point. You should know how important he is to this offense. But I think you have, even during these wins, you've kind of felt some of those pockets where like, ooh, they did usually have another guy that could get them to the second side and add a level of variety. And they don't have that right now.
But I think that kind of speaks to who OKC has become as a team to be able to find different ways to get back to still having a level of flow. Like, it's not like they're automatically stuck in the mud. They have a conviction they play with offensively that I think's been impressive, and being able to use different pressure points and being able to use continuity between their lineups. So it doesn't matter who's in the lineup, AJ Mitchell, Aaron Wiggins, everyone knows what their task is. Everyone knows how they can attack. And they're always kind of keeping and finding different ways to keep pressure on you. So you think it's a guard screen. They swing to the second side real quick. Now, are you ready to close out? Are you ready for the second attack? And so I think for me, it's more about just tempo for them. Get to the next action, get to the next drive, continue to play out of things. When they kind of struggle a little bit, I think it's early screen, quick attack, quick shot. I like that for them as far as the aggression, but at the same time, are you punishing teams as much as you could is a question I end up asking myself.
Okay. No, that's fair. And I think this isn't necessarily a new point for you. Like, even heading into the eventual title win for OKC last year, you've consistently said this is an incredibly good basketball team because duh, but if you are trying to get the Thunder, get them into quick shot land. And that gives you the opportunity to run against them before they can set their ferocious defense. You can kind of go that way. So like, I think this is a very consistent point that you brought up, and I think it's a fair one. And it's been interesting to watch OKC kind of work through that again as they deal with the Isaiah Hartenstein injury. So I like that from you, Steve. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to go ahead because I had a question about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander offensively before we transition to the defensive side. But I'm curious as to what you were going to say.
Oh, well, actually, we can hang there with the offense since we're kind of here. What was your Shea question? Because I also have a lot of Shea thoughts about not just the Spurs game, but this run overall.
I mean, for me, it's something that just kind of popped in the Houston game, where Houston, who, you know, they have double big lineups, they have size, they have length. It would probably seem like, hey, they're a switch team against, you know, Shea and the Thunder. But they were a little bit more active in pick and roll. And I was going to ask you, how did you feel about, hey, high pick and roll with Shea? No, we're just going to trap that and we're going to rotate behind it. And OKC, you have to figure out a way to find the openings, and we're going to trust that we can rotate behind it and get you into a different position. And a little bit of consistency, because they mixed it in. And it's hard because you have to try and show different things to Shea. And it's not like it's a new thing for Shea to see. But does it have a different weight against some of the taller teams, some of the better teams in the Western Conference? Does it contain something that could open things up? Because, you know, and this could just be because Hardenstein's not out there, but, you know, is that something you can go to? The problem is when you show Shea that, he kind of knows, and he got to rejects in the second half and decided, actually, I'm not going to come off that screen. And I'm going to actually just make a quick decision when you put two on the ball, and I'm gonna get, accept this, keep driving, advance it, and now we're gonna take advantage of what we have. Mm-hmm. And so do you think that's something that more teams should go to, or do you think it's something that isn't really viable?
I like it. It's the age old, how much of this is this team's personnel versus a template that you can use elsewhere. I love that this has become a theme of our Thunder conversations. I would say I was intrigued by Houston being as aggressive. And like, quickly on that front, I'm glad you went there because I had this in my notes. Shea saw two on the ball on about 47% of his pick and rolls against Houston on Thursday night. Easily the highest rate that he has seen in a game this season. And like, you consider some of the teams that they played, it's like, oh, well, they are facing some teams that naturally have their bigs at the level and want to get aggressive anyway. So the fact that Houston, of all teams, was the one to kind of ramp it up against them was very interesting to me. And it felt like a direct foil to, they sprinkled it in the season opener. So like, it's not new in this matchup, but to this volume, I was like, oh, this is a lot. And so like, I don't know how many teams can afford to be that aggressive, that consistently against OKC. Like, I do think it's a fair gambit in general. When you think about some of the lineups that OKC puts out there and some of the shooters that are going to be out there, like, if it's two on the ball against Shea, early relief pass to Jalen Williams, and then the ball swings to Lu Dort, who, again, has shot well from three over the past two or three seasons, not so much this year. I think defenses are still in the mind, like, if Lu Dort makes six threes, then we're just going to lose to Lu Dort making six threes. And it's a similar deal with Cason Wallace. Not so much the case with A.J. Mitchell, but you get what I'm saying. Like, they have enough role players to where teams can, yes, we can afford to be a little bit more aggressive than we are accustomed to with some of the lines that OKC puts out. 47%, like that, I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can do that. And like, this is a middling defense as of late for Houston. We should probably have another conversation maybe next week or so about what's been happening with Houston the last few weeks.
A tease.
So you got that. But like, overall this year, and just throughout the Ime Udoka tenure, they have been an elite defense. And even with them, I'm like, I don't know if you want to do it this often. But to that point, Steve, it was interesting to watch Shea work through that, because you mentioned some of the rejects in the second half. Going back to that first game, they hit Shea with those traps, and here's a turnover with Amen Thompson kind of challenging the pass. Shea double clutches one, it goes the other way. Another high pick and roll on the left side of the floor. Shea gets two on the ball, quick hands from, I think, Reed Shepherd, and then that's going the other way. It's like, oh, okay. And so, you know, watching that game this morning, that's where I thought, oh, they're just going to sprinkle it in and then go back to like switching or just start back mixing coverages. I wasn't anticipating it being as consistent as it was. But as we get there, that's where you get to, as I mentioned earlier, oh, you're sending two on the ball. I don't have to hit, you know, Jalen Williams or Chad or whoever screened it for me early. I can just hit this guy on the wing and then let them make the decision. And so, like, they were able to create, in that first quarter in particular, they were able to generate some really good looks there. A couple of missed threes. And so you look at the overall, like, points per possession number Shea had in those looks. It's probably lower than you would anticipate, but that's because we generated a high-quality shot. It just missed. So that's just a zero in the spreadsheet type beat. But, like, he started getting more comfortable with that. He then did start hitting the roller on some of those. That created some two-on-one opportunities getting downhill. And then, to your point, Steve, now it's reject time. I know you're trying to get a guy up here. I'm going the other way. And this also kind of ties it to my general Shea observation. And it also popped in the Spurs game as well, if we're going back. Shea is just operating, at least to me, and I'd be curious if anyone like OKC media can like ask him this at some point. It feels like to me he has like sped up his internal clock. Because I think the fun thing with Shea overall is the cadence that he plays with. Going to lull you to sleep with some of these dribbles. You don't know when I'm going to cross over. You don't know when I'm going to step back. And then once he actually gets it to his gather, you don't know how quick that's going to be. When he pulls the ball up, this may be one pump fake. It may be two pump fakes. It may be two pump fakes and then a pivot another way. And then he's going into a shot. As of late, it's very much been whatever Shea's move is, I am going immediately into my shot. It was one of the things that I noted early on in that Spurs game where Stephon Castle did one heck of a job guarding him early. And I'd say overall, he did a really good job of staying in front of him.
Not in the opinion of Shea Gilgeous-Alexander.
That is true. But I'm saying, like, Stephon mirrored him well. He bodied him up. And I think very early on, Shea decided, like, oh, okay, I've seen Stephon multiple times at this point. I don't know if I can get into the fake bag like that. Like, I don't think he's going to be biting on those. I just got to get to whatever I feel like my spot is on this possession and just go rise up. Because ultimately, they're not going to block my shot. If I could get the angle on them, like, is this up to me to make the shot? And so that really popped in that Spurs game. And overall, it's just been a lot of, this is the matchup. This is the coverage. I am getting to the elbow. I am rising. I am dribbling to my left. I'm going to my step back. I am rising immediately. Step back three, I'm just going immediately. And like, it's been fun to kind of watch that because I know as a defender, Shea is difficult enough to deal with in and of itself. If he's now just streamlining his attacks to disagree, then it's like, well, shoot, how aggressive do I need to be now? And you know, the second you decide, I need to ramp this up, I need to be more jumpy because he is now playing a little faster than we've gotten used to, the pump fakes are going to be right back. And he's going to be getting right back to the line. He's still getting to the line, but like he's going to be right back to the line on like some of the non-shooting fouls and stuff like that. And so the cat and mouse game that he's playing with defenders has been a joy for me. Again, popped in the Spurs matchup, popped in that Rockets matchup, to the point about dealing with those traps. You saw it in the Miami matchup. You mentioned the 16 in the third quarter. He has just been very good during the stretch. I think he's over 30 points a game still. The 20-point streak still remains for him. Had exactly 20, I believe, against Houston on Thursday. But I've enjoyed that part of the Shea process.
I'm glad you have. And I would like to talk about the one thing I always enjoy about the Oklahoma City Thunder, Nekias, and that is the defense.
Let's go.
And I think the biggest thing defensively, we know about the effort that they play with. We know about the physicality, but they can shape shift at times and just disrupt your flow. And they just play with an activity about them. You know, ball pressure on a catch. And when you get to pick and roll, they work to navigate screens. The big might be at the level and they might decide to trap. And all of a sudden, now you're trying to figure out where to go now. The ability to switch, you're seeing Thunder jerseys in the paint. You work to get movement on the second side of the floor. Another switch. Now you get to pick and roll. You're thinking, okay, they trapped me. No, I'm up here, but I'm dropping back. And now we're going to use our personnel to navigate this screen and kind of work to keep you in front. Openings are there against Oklahoma City, but they close in a split second. So it looks like you have a driving lane. It looks like you may have a kick out, but they're helping. They're recovering. They're getting back. And now we're just going to navigate. And, you know, it's not just one look that you're going to end up seeing. You want to end up attacking Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, something you brought up, right? You want to put him in action against Houston. Okay, he's guarding Kevin Durant or he's guarding Alperen Şengün. Well, here's a double team. And on top of that, here's us showing bodies and helping. And we're going to dig on the move and we'll figure it out. So that puts you in a position where how often are you going to go back to that after his attempts? When do you go after him? Is it the start of the game or the end of the game? And then they have this really, hey, you have a really good player over there? Here's Alex Caruso. So what does that turn into? Does that player still initiate? Does the ball pressure make you slower? Do things slow down off ball because of his efforts? Are you ready for the physicality? He's going to put his paws on you, and he's going to do it in a way that the refs, A, can't see because he's going to show his hands right after, and B, he's not going to stop.
He is not going to stop at all.
So the way that they can just kind of throw different things at you to, oh, you think you found something, we're just going to tweak it a little bit. And then it's like, hey, cool, here's Jalen Williams as well. Just throw that out there for you. So it's a reminder that there's pressure on offenses to find a way to sustain against OKC, which is difficult to deal with.
No, I think that's fair. And like quickly to the Houston game, you know, I've said this before with Second Spectrum, like what's a post-up versus what's an isolation can get kind of muddy sometimes. Just with how that's just general tracking data type beat. But per second spectrum in that Houston game, 13 post possessions for Houston, 0.17 points per possession on post touches in that game against OKC. What do you mean? It's almost literally zero. They did not have a good time. Alperen Şengün did not have a good time. But, like, naturally, there's grace. One, OKC is really good. Two, Şengün is, what, two games back into his return? So, like, you obviously just give a little bit of grace there. But, yeah, to your point, like, the swarming, the way they're able to cross match, the help they're able to show, it's all been fun. Like, that brings me back, you know, annoyingly so for some, I apologize. But that brings me back to that Spurs game, Steve. And it brings me back to the Wembanyama matchup. As I talked a little bit earlier about him being in the middle of the floor and what that conveys, just the general attention that he draws. We get to the very first possession of that game on Tuesday, and it's like a variation of double drag or a double pick and roll, and OKC botches it immediately. I'm just like, there's no way we're doing this again. I immediately had Charlotte flashbacks. I was like, there's no way that this is what it's going to be. But they cleaned it up, and boy, did they clean it up. And I think with what they did with Victor Wembanyama in that game, they maintain kind of like their matchup principles. We're going to have smaller guys on him. There was a handful of possessions where Chet got the matchup. There was the very early dunk, and I was like, oh boy, that's kind of tough. But like even within that possession and the overall theme of that game for me, with the Wemby touches in the middle or just his drives in general, OKC had their help, but it felt like the help was coming a little bit later. Like, I appreciated any time Wemby was starting his gather, here comes a swipe. There may be multiple players sinking in. If you're in a strong side corner, I don't care. I'm helping off of you, Harrison Barnes. It does not matter. We're making sure Wemby is not comfortable. And this kind of goes back to something that you said a little bit earlier this year about Wemby. As good as he is, like, he is still working to tighten the handle. I think you can still poke at things when it comes to things like that. But, like, you see that physicality when Caruso gets the matchup or Jalen Williams gets the matchup or Kenrich Williams gets the matchup. We're digging under you. We're pushing your catches out. If you're trying to set up a post up, we have this layer of help behind you. You're not going to have a good time. And the second he gathers, here's multiple bodies. Can you make live dribble reads? Like, I just felt like it was a very good job of disrupting him. And to that end, and I'll close it here, 37 touches for Wemby in that game against OKC. That's the third lowest number that he's had in the game this season. 0.73 points per possession on any trip featuring a Wemby touch, which was easily the lowest of the season. And he saw a second defender or a flat-out double team on nearly 30% of his touches. That was the highest mark that Wemby has seen this year. It was pristine stuff from OKC in that matchup. And again, it's a window into who they've been for most of the year. This is why they have the best defensive rating in basketball by a mile. But even in this particular matchup, like, they can still do this to people. And so, like, as you brought up the defense, I was like, ah, man, I had thoughts, wanted to get those out. It's been a lot of fun watching this group kind of find itself again.
Understood. And speaking of fun, we have more fun for you after this break. We're going to talk about most improved and have a good time together.
All right, we are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot. And Steve, we're a little more than halfway through the season now, and it's time for not a full-blown most improved player deep dive. We're going to do that a little bit later. Not this episode, but that's coming. Just be on the lookout for that episode. We're going to try to get a guest for that. We're going to have some fun. But we did want to have like an earnest discussion about the most improved player award, especially for the new folks to our show. We have differing thoughts on how the award should be voted on and such. Steve, how do you generally view the Most Improved Player Award?
Well, here's the thing. I think reflection is important in life. I think communication is important in life. And so we're going to test growth here today. So if you are a longtime listener of the podcast, if you are new, I will layer some context in to hopefully make this make sense. Perceive however you would like. That's fine. I went back this morning to my notes from 2022. And that was the beginning of this conversation and the feeling of, hey, this award really has changed. Y'all better not do this. Please don't do this. And so the award kind of flowed from, ooh, wow, our bad. Did not know you could do this, to, hey, you're good and you made a leap to more good. And we sure need to recognize that somewhere. So here you go. You're the most improved player. And I remember going back to 2022 and having a discussion with you and telling you I had a sinking feeling down the stretch that Ja Morant was going to win that award. Mm-hmm. And you know who won that award, Nikias?
I believe it was Ja Morant.
Ja Morant. Somewhere in my phone is a clip of my reaction when you told me you had Ja Morant as your most improved player. We don't have to play that right now. Okay. I think bonding and healing is important. I understand and recognize that it's not easy to make the jump from 20 a night to 27 a night. I think Tyrese Maxey also echoed the same thing. It's not easy to bring the same level of consistency. I think it just opens the door for a very specific set of names that are already established and good to just kind of dominate the top. And I think it takes away from some of the other leaps that might not have that specific volume, but are still important. Now, last year, with it being Dyson Daniels and then Zubac and then Cade, maybe that restores some order. But I think there's an interesting list of names this year, because somewhere in the world, someone hearing my voice is going to say Jaylen Brown is the most improved player. And I don't agree with that. He's had a great year. He's in a different thing over there. Not here, over there. He's over there. And then now I got to thinking this morning. Okay, so does Jalen Johnson just run away with this thing? You go from 18, 10, and 5 assists to 23 points, 10 rebounds, 8 assists, 9 in, 9 out. Stamp him, that's it. Do you just hand it to Michael Porter Jr.? Going from 18 a night to 25? Does Jalen Duren win this? Going from 12 and 10 to 18 and 11? With improved offense and improved attack, and the Pistons are winning, what do we do with Nikhil Alexander Walker? He had not averaged 10 or more points since like 2021-22, and he's a 20-point-a-night scorer. Does Dylan Brooks sneak in here? Especially with how some people have felt about him at his last two stops. Not only has he helped turn things around in Phoenix, but the defensive effort that he brings, and oh yeah, he's averaging 21 a night. That feels like people that are going to get attention on top of some other names that I haven't even thought of who may be all-star adjacent. Mm-hmm. But that takes away, in my opinion, from the Keontae George, who's had an incredible year in Utah, from Ryan Rollins, who has showcased the level of talent we didn't think he had in him consistently. Anthony Black has been a revelation in Orlando. Colin Gillespie, you can even talk Jaime Jaquez, Keyshawn George. Like, there are players that are making consistent leaps that I don't know if they're going to get recognized this year. And I'm a tad bit concerned.
I think that's fair. And I'd say, one, I appreciate you for adding that context and allowing us to heal as a podcast. There you go. But second, to the heart of your argument, like, this is where, like, we diverge a little bit in terms of what the award is and why I have always consistently recognized, like, I feel like I am in the minority on this. I think more people, especially more people that are listening to us, feel the way that you do about how the award should be voted on than the way that I feel. But to that end, like, my main disagreement with how it's looked at is that, as you describe it, it feels more like a who exceeded my expectations award versus who actually improved the most. And, like, I think there is overlap, or there can be overlap to that. But this is where, as you mentioned at the top, like, I wasn't upset with, I ultimately landed on Ja Morant being most improved, because I thought the leap that he made, and I know we had like a back and forth about Ja versus Desmond Bane on the same team that season. But, like, I thought the leap that he made as the number one option, how everything jumped with more defensive attention and where the Grizzlies went that year, things like that. Like, I valued that leap a little bit more. I don't think it is always the star that goes to superstar, or the all-star that goes to star, or the star that goes to, I don't think that is always going to be the biggest leap or the most impactful leap. I try to view the award as literally as possible for me. And I say this as someone that doesn't have an official ballot, but it's, how much did you improve? How much did you get better? And I don't immediately eliminate good players from that. And I say that not trying to throw shade or anything like that. But, like, I think that's where our main disagreement is. As you mentioned, Jaylen Brown is an example. I don't immediately disqualify him because he's an all-star level player. If he's made a leap, he's made a leap. And for me, my conversation, as I try to parse through my list, is, did Jaylen Brown improve more than Nikhil Alexander Walker, or improve more than Kyle Gillespie? I may land on one of those two improving more, but, like, I don't immediately just take him out because he's good. And, like, that part has always kind of bothered me about the conversation. And so, like, I think that's where our main split comes in. And so, as you've mentioned some names, I have four categories of players. And you've stepped on a bunch of them already. So I'm glad that we are mostly in lockstep. And so the categories
that
I have.
What are these categories?
It's just four different types of most improved places. Or most improved cases, excuse me.
Okay, what's happening? Let's do it.
Okay, so I have like the star cases bit, which is, you know, the starter that leaps to all-star or all-star to star, those kind of things. So you already mentioned Jaylen Brown. You mentioned Jalen Johnson. You mentioned Jalen Duren. You mentioned Michael Porter Jr. You mentioned Keontae George, who I have in this category. And so other names, I just want to ask how you feel about them. Like, I know you don't prioritize these overall for this award. So I get that part.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Is this still the star territory?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So still in star territory. Is it fair to include them in the star territory? Not asking you to say they should win the award. So games played minimum is going to hurt him right now. But Austin Reeves, does that feel like a fair name to add to that type of player making that leap?
I don't think Austin Reeves is. I understand because of the leap that he made early this season.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was pretty good beforehand. Continue.
Okay, fair enough. So we got Austin Reeves. Mentioned Tyrese Maxey.
Again?
Yeah.
I already did the Tyrese Maxey thing, didn't we?
He's taking another leap, but the name worth writing down in the star division. Denny Avdija, who's probably going to make the All-Star team this year, but has made a pretty massive leap. Played well, did close out last year, but like this is sustained. He's been very good, very impactful. You mentioned Keontae George already. If you mentioned Jaylen Brown, we also just did a breakdown on Anthony Edwards, who's having like easily the best scoring season of his career and has expanded in the middle of the floor in particular. Since he's gotten better. Steve has the wow face. He's like, I can't believe.
Continue.
That you brought him up. Okay. So these will be like, if you are building a case for a star level player or all-star level player, those would be the names that I would be thinking about in that case. So then we get into this next category. You got your mid-tier leaps, role players or low-level starters that have bumped into like legitimate impact guys, right? So that's where I have Nickeil Alexander-Walker. That's where I have Jaime Jaquez Jr., who you already mentioned. You mentioned Ryan Rollins as well. And like Ryan Rollins was an interesting person for me to place within my own categories. I intimately landed with him. And like the next category is going to be like the where did you come from, which is more so like what you were talking about at the beginning. Like I didn't know you could do all that type beat. I almost had Ryan Rollins there, but like he did start like 19 games or 13 games or so to close out last regular season. Like he was in Milwaukee's rotation to close the year. So it's not super new. But like obviously the role has been different and he has played very well this season. And that's also where I have Anthony Black, another guy that you mentioned. Would there be anyone else that you would add to that kind of like mid-tier list?
No, it sounds great.
Okay.
It sounds great.
And so in the where'd you come from division, like I think Colin Gillespie just kind of signifies what this is.
Good.
And not that he, you know, got a little bit of playing time last year, but he has just turned himself into a solid point guard offensively, incredible shooter this year. Pesky defensively, teams do still try to put him in action. It's him and a bunch of other good defenders on the floor, so naturally, let's get after him. But like he feels like the guy. And then in the final category, I have generally been year three or more. But like logically, if I am of the mind the award is who improved the most, like in a literal sense, I probably should not exclude year two guys. And so as far as the year two guys concerned, some names that I had down in that segment: Alex Saar in Washington, Stephon Castle in San Antonio, Matas Buzelis, more efficient inside the arc. The defense has been solid. Starting to pass the ball a little bit more, which is exciting to me. We'll see where the shooting lands. Khalil Ware, though, that clearly depends on what night you catch him on at this point, because Eric Spoelstra had some things to say following the game against the Boston Celtics. So we'll see, but has generally been good this year for Miami. Keyshawn George, also in Washington. Another year two guy making an impact. And I wanted to mention him in the first segment, but we were flowing. AJ Mitchell, Steve.
There it is.
AJ Mitchell, during his win streak, 17-4-4, plus 57 in 151 minutes. The Thunder have won his minutes in all five of these games. They are 30-2 when they win the AJ Mitchell minutes. Now, this is a very good team, so like you can take that stat with a grain of salt if you want. But he's been impactful often if they win when he plays well. He's been one of the better drivers in the league this year, and especially during this win streak. On the year, the Thunder outscoring teams by over 20 points per 100 possessions with him and Shea on the floor together. is like plus 14 with Shea on without AJ Mitchell. It's plus 12 with AJ Mitchell on without Shea. So it's not even like he's just a Shea merchant and getting buckets that way. His drives and his overall shot creation has been very important for this group. So like those would be some of the year two guys, if I'm going to consider them, that I would be looking at for this discussion. Are those names fair? Would you take anyone off? Is there anyone you would add?
Fantastic job. And so salute to you for building the Nekias top 50 in this award. Well done. Much appreciated. We all appreciate what you do. We did it as a podcast, as a group, together. I do have one question, though.
Okie dokie.
So Tyrese Maxey was sixth in the award in 21-22 and won the award in 23-24.
Mm-hmm.
How much more improving are we giving him credit for?
I think that depends on him, no? Or at least in theory, it should.
Would you like to talk about Unrivaled?
You know what? That feels like a safe thing to do so we can actually have a podcast next week. Let's move on to the Unrivaled schedule this weekend. An interesting slate of games this weekend. Unfortunately, was not in Miami. I'm naturally home, so didn't get to do like the practice things, but we're going to get some insight for you heading into next week. Excited about that. But later on tonight, Steve, we have Laces versus Phantom, a pair of 2-1 teams. And then in the nightcap, you have the undefeated Rose, last year's champions, Chelsea Gray, leading the league in scoring right now at nearly 32 points per game, taking on the young upstart Hive, which one thing I meant to mention and did not when we talked about Unrivaled last time, was going through just general takeaways and things. Sanaya Rivers' defense is absurd. And it was very good during her rookie year in the W. And like she was someone, did not have official ballot to be clear, but she was someone that was on my short list, ultimately did not make my fictional all defense team, but she was someone I thought really hard about because of how good she was on that end. She has been insane to start this Unrivaled season. She is leading Unrivaled in blocks, and that is off the backs of a 7-block game against Breeze BC, which is the Unrivaled record at this point. But overall, and you stood in the opener against I think Miss BC, where hey, let's just try to post up Sanaya Rivers since we have all the size. And Sanaya is just like, well, one, I may just warm around you and I'm going to steal this entry pass so you can't get there anyway. Or two, if you do get it, as soon as you try to turn, I'm probably stripping you. And if you do try to get a shot up, I might just block that. And so it's been very fun to watch that. So I would imagine at some point we are going to see Sanaya, Sanaya defending Chelsea. And I just want to see what that looks like. That is what I'm excited about. Anything from the Friday slate, excite you, Steve?
I'm curious to see who is going to stop Chelsea Gray at any point in time, and if it's possible to do that in the Sephora Arena. Because I'm not certain that it can be done, because she's been insane. I'm intrigued by Laces and Phantom. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question I would ask you is just a quick free throw. Who has the best duo right now in Unrivaled? Scoring-wise.
Oh, the best scoring duo.
The best scoring duo. Is it Marina Mabry and Aaliyah Edwards? Is it De'Erica Hamby and Ryan Howard? Is it Paige and Rekia?
It's probably De'Erica and Ryan right now, which again, salute to De'Erica Hamby for setting the Unrivaled record with 40 points in a recent outing. But, like, it's probably those two. Like, I was trying to figure out who would be the second with Chelsea. Like, I would love to say Chelsea and Azaray. But like the Azaray scoring season at the very least has been up and down so far. It's super early, obviously. But yeah, it's probably the vinyl duo. Like, I think you got to go De'Erica and Ryan. And I'll just give a quick hat tip to Teresa Witherspoon. She's done a really good job of scheming both of them open. Like, the Ryan off-ball stuff has been really fun this year. And it popped some last year as well. But just a kudos there. But I'm right there with you. Like, I think that's going to be a fascinating one. One thing that I've kind of chuckled at with this, because we didn't get to see a ton of Alyssa Thomas and Jackie Young last year because Jackie was dealing with the knee stuff. It is very funny coming off of that final series to watch Jackie Young screening for Alyssa Thomas.
Yeah, it's a good bit.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder if either of them kind of hit a point during a practice. I'm like, this is kind of like, I was just putting my shoulder into your chest and now you were giving me a driving lane. Like, this is kind of This is odd. But obviously you got like the Team USA experience together, so it probably isn't that weird. But like I did chuckle thinking about that the other day. So excited about that. A question that I'll toss your way, Steve, to the Laces Phantom matchup. One of the things that's intrigued me, talked about this recently, was like the rise of these double big lineups. How much Kiki plus Aaliyah do you think we see against the Laces? And how do you think the Laces are going to counter if they do see that?
So I don't know how much you want to do that. I don't know how much you want to do that. Cause here's my thought process. They can match that energy in a different way. Mm. And so are you ready for that portion of the program? Like, it's not like their guards are small.
That's also true.
So, hey, are you ready to defend on the other end? Are you ready for that portion of the program? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Like, that just feels like a really interesting battle for me. Because, like, to your point, like, even if the Laces stay with, like, their traditional matchup or trend smaller, like, Jackie Young isn't easy to post up. you know what I mean? Like, that's not a good... She's one of these strongest perimeter players in the league. But then I look on the other side, and it's just like, how many bigs seal as well as Kiki Iriafin or Aaliyah Boston? Like, it's Bree Jones and who?
That's a fair point.
And so, like, as strong as Jackie is and as good of a defender she is, like, you do still have to deal with the size difference, and they have the technical stuff, too. And as you get to, does that become, like, a foul trouble thing? Because this is a physical defense on top of that. Like, I'm just fascinated to see that cat and mouse. And, like, you know, to the Laces, like, do you try to size up and put another big alongside Lisa Thomas? Like, they don't have a bunch of them on the roster. But, like, what does that look like if they do try to size? Like, that's where I'm super intrigued about what that matchup is going to look like. We get to the Saturday slate, Steve. We get Miss BC versus the Lunar Owls. You already mentioned the scoring of Marina Mabry and Aaliyah Edwards. Lunar Owls still looking for their first dub. And we have Breeze BC, Paige and Rakia and Dom and Cam and all the crew against Vinyl BC. And buddy, let me tell you, I guess first to the Mist, like one, there's just a general, can the Lunar Owls get their first win? Related to that, do we see Skylar Diggins this weekend?
Buddy, I don't know, but I tell you what we are going to see. Field goal attempts and buckets from Aaliyah Edwards and Marina Mabry. And then the question is, can they shoot their way into a win? Mm. Because they are going to get them up. Did you see the box score against the Laces?
It's all.
The Lunar Owls took 52 shots, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rebecca Allen, Rachel Banham, and Timmy took 10.
They know where the bread is buttered. They know who got to bring it on.
Just want to throw it out there. Yeah. It's going to be very fascinating against a very good and dynamic Miss team that can, yeah, we got bucket getting and, oh, we're tall and we can defend. And, mm-hmm. Hey, we're going to shoot. Doesn't matter. So I'm intrigued by that portion.
That should be a fun one. So, again, I hope we do see Skylar. She would certainly help. She would help the Lunar Owls on both ends, but I think she certainly would help some of the offensive organization. Hey, Steve, do you think Alicia Gray comes off the bench again in this one?
You are monitoring this, aren't you?
It's so funny seeing people up in arms about this. I'm just like, I don't think it's that big of a deal. Like,
but it's
she closes,
just, it's...
they start second halves, like, ultimately, when the games matter, because I think they're going to make the playoffs, like, she's going to be starting when it matters. Like, I don't really care, but it's been funny kind of looking, seeing some of the stuff.
Hey, here's a whole bunch of defense. Hey, here's Lee Yeroux, and also Arike, and also Alicia Gray. I think it's okay. I think it's just mix and match. It's fine.
I think it's going to be fun. And then to the nightcap, you got Breeze and Vinyl. Who boy. De'Erica Bucket getting, Ryan Bucket getting, Paige Bucket getting. I think I am excited about the clipboards in this one, frankly. Could talk a little bit about some of the off-ball fun that Teresa Witherspoon is having with Ryan. Noelle Quinn has had a lot of fun drawing up stuff for Paige Beckers off the ball. And just in general, her usage of the bigs as hubs and then getting into some of those splits and stuff, that's going to be fun. I feel like if I have the ability to clip from that game, I'm going to be clipping a lot from that game because I think there's going to be some fun stuff in that one. Do you think Ryan gets the Paige matchup, by the way? You think she's guarding Paige?
Yes. I'm going to say that because I asked that question last week and I got in trouble. So, oops. Yeah. Yeah, man. Shout out to Lexi Hall, man.
Yeah, hey, listen, I'm glad that people are enjoying our unrivaled content. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I will say, just to quickly recap the Sunday and Monday games, sign me up for Breeze Mist. These are my two teams. And also, Kelsey Plum and Marina Mabry are going to have MVP-type campaign weekends. But it won't matter. It's Chelsea Gray. It's Chelsea Gray.
Ops. Well, there you go. There you go. As you mentioned, the weekend. I'm going to close it up quickly here. Jackie versus Chelsea in the Who Does Becky Love More Bowl. I think it's going to be a good bit. So that should be a funny one. Also, Chelsea probably going to guard Alyssa Thomas at some point. And, buddy, am I excited to see that again. As we are, again, not too far removed from the finals matchup. That should be a good bit. Yeah, shots going to be up between the Kelseys. Breeze Mist should be a fun one. This is a fun slate, Steve. I'm excited.
It is. We have more fun, though, Nikias. Tell the people.
Yes. As we've wrapped up Unrivaled Talk, after the break, we had a conversation earlier this week with Becky Hammon, head coach of the Las Vegas Aces, Hall of Famer, all the things. We hope you enjoy the chat. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to this episode of The Dunker Spot, and we have a very special guest with us on the W side as a player, 6-time All-Star, 4-time All-W, member of the W25 team, 25 of the greatest and most influential players in W history. On the NBA side, a legendary assistant coach, a summer league champion, back to the W side as a head coach, 3 championships in 4 years, including the most recent one. We have the Hall of Famer, Becky Hammon, in the building. Coach, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Excited to talk to you guys because, Nikias, you always have the best questions. So you talk hoops on a level that I like. So excited to talk to you both.
I appreciate that. I do have some more basketball questions for you. But first, I want to ask about you. One, you have a documentary in the works. It seems exciting. What went into that decision? How long has this been under wraps?
I get people coming to me all the time about writing a book or doing a documentary. I've put it off for so long. Now I'm starting to just get old. I'm like, well, I better put it out there before I get too old and nobody cares. It's going to be very interesting because, I used to do a diary a lot. I used to write a lot. Mm. And just when I got working with the Spurs, I just got really too busy. So what I did is I'd do recordings on my way to work of whatever was going on. And so what a lot of this documentary is a lot of those recordings, the good, the bad, the ugly. And so it's, I don't even know what's on those recordings. I've forgotten what I've said, but the guy was like, you have 18 hours of you talking into that. So it's going to be an interesting take as well as, some of the more recent things that have been going on, but I don't really even know how it's all going to frame out right now, Nikias. When I find out, I'll let you and Steve know. But it's very much in the preliminary works right now.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, not going to steal too much from the documentary, but I did want to do a little background. What initially drew you to basketball?
Oh man. I've always loved basketball. I wouldn't say there was one draw. Probably just tagging around with my dad and my brother all the time. My dad was always playing in like city leagues or church leagues. So I'd be going, I'd shoot at the on the side baskets the whole time. But really, from a very, very small age, I've had a basketball in my hands. I've loved it from day one. As I got older, just fell in love with the work and just playing. And I was just kind of wired differently, honestly, because I know we'd go to camps and I'd be right back in the gym right when we got back from the camp. And all my friends would be like, ugh, aren't you like tired of basketball? So I knew I was a little different back then. Cause I just, it just wasn't normal, to be putting in work. You really have to be obsessed with it. And I've kind of been obsessed with it since day one.
I guess bouncing off of that, this is a question that I asked Noel Quinn not too long ago ahead of the Unrivaled season. Are you able to casually enjoy basketball at this point? Or are you so now entrenched with the work that it's hard to kind of turn that off?
I don't think you can ever look at it like just normal as a fan. It's like you know and you've seen too much. So it's really hard to like even watch any kind of level and be like, oh man, like, you know, what are you doing? Or that was great or whatever it might be. But, you know, I have two boys now and they're both in basketball. And I try really, really hard to not be like a yelling parent, which clearly I can be a yelling coach at times. But like I tell my team, I'm like, I don't even yell in my real life. Ask my kids. But now that my kids are starting to grow up and get into, you know, some more sports, I try to really bite my tongue and just be a cheerleader over there for him. Both of them. But it's interesting, the parent aspect of it for sure.
So we're not going to see you coaching like a middle school team anytime soon.
Oh, no. No. I know I don't have the patience for that. So, you know, I like to go out and shoot and spend time with my boys, you know, on the court or really doing whatever they want. I want to, you know, make a very clear communication and very clear statement that like, I want them to do what they want to do. You know, my one youngest said to me, I was like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he was like, you know, a basketball player. I'm like, well, why do you want to be a basketball player? He's like, cause you were. I'm like, but you could do whatever you want. You don't have to be a basketball player because mom was a basketball player. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do whatever you want to do. If it's a football or a baseball, whatever, a musician, whatever. Now you got to do something. you got to do something, but it doesn't have to be a basketball player. I really just want them to kind of find their own footing and find their own way with what they're passionate about. You know, I know not everybody's wired like me, just from a competitive standpoint, you know. So I try to let people be who they are, and I want to be who I am. So I try not to push too hard there.
Makes sense. Before you transition, Steve, did you have anything before we dig into the basketball at all?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this season. And first, have you been able to fully decompress from the year at this point?
I would say yes, but it took me a while. It took a while to like kind of get everything out of my head, clear my head, clear my thinking space. I didn't open my computer for about a month. So that's like, now not to say I wasn't watching a lot on TV, but so far as clipping things and working per se, you know, I was able to close my computer, close my eyes, sleep a little bit. But I feel like, you know, rejuvenated, ready to get back in it. I'm starting to watch all our games back and kind of get back into the flow of things.
Okay. What did you learn about yourself this season?
What did I learn about myself? You know, just just like anything in life, you have to have a stick-to-itiveness. You have to have an understanding that the process and growth isn't easy. It's just not. That's part of it. And so in those really hard times, just kind of shoring up, not if I was going to figure it out or if we were going to figure it out. It was just when we were going to figure it out. And just you just keep at it. You just keep working until it the pieces fall into place, until it clicks. And sometimes, you know, you sound like a broken record as a coach. You just feel like you're saying saying the same things over and over. But it's my job to reinforce those kind of things. You know, it's my job to keep coaching them when it's not good. Everybody can coach and do things when it's easy and it's coming, everything's flowing and everything feels good. What I wanted to make sure and what I already knew, I wouldn't say I learned this about myself, but what I know I'm good at it is just bringing people together and keeping people on board. You got to keep people on board through the tough times. Nobody gets to jump ship. And just staying encouraging to them, but it was finding out ways to continually try to get the best out of them in situations. And a lot of times, some of that has nothing to do with the basketball court. It's mentally reminding them who they are and how great they are. And I felt like that was when I really started to dial into that aspect as a leader, you know, because it wasn't about X's and O's at a certain point. Like it's now between, you know, your ears and your heart and getting those to connect on a certain level, building that trust up and creating some safe places. I think, you know, our team was kind of coming out of some trauma as well as some individuals. You know, we lost a lot of players, and I know that that hurt our players. It hurts, you know, when people decide to leave. You know, but you kind of have to get back up and put the pieces back together. And I guess one thing that I learned is just every season is its own season. Mm-hmm. Every player, just because they were this player, you know, last year, doesn't mean they're going to come in and be this player this year. Like, every team kind of has to form their own identity. Jewel coming out of her Seattle situation, even Dana coming out of her Chicago situation. I feel like everybody was kind of like playing a little bit injured there at the beginning, whether that be from a mental and an emotional standpoint, affects what you're doing. And I really feel like the psychology part of coaching really was a learning curve for me, but also just a process of constantly learning and constantly just trying to, how are we going to get better? I mean, even right now in January, it's like my mind is constantly, how are we going to get better? How are we going to, you know, how are we going to squeeze the rock and get a little bit more out of it? Mm-hmm. So your mind really never turns off. But it was definitely a head and heart issue with us early on in the season. And I felt like until we really created a really safe, secure environment for them to grow and build confidence in themselves and one another, it was going to be rocky. It was just going to be rocky. And, you know, what I do know about rocky waters is preparing you for something. And so, you know, I'm big on process. And so when I saw the process, and I saw the growth during the process, even though it wasn't always, you know, culminating to a win. You know, we all want to win, of course. Mm-hmm. But as long as we were moving in the right direction and we were keeping everybody on board, I felt good about the potential that this team always had, and I always believed they had.
Well, I was going to ask, how do you balance when you know what your team can be and what they can accomplish, and you're currently showing flashes of it or getting pieces of it, and just, I know it's here. I know we have it. How do you kind of just navigate that portion? Because I feel like for people when they're watching, you're like, oh, well, they're not doing this, and that. And it's like, well, they're doing it. It's just not as consistent as it could be. How do you kind of just balance that out throughout the season?
Well, I think you're really talking about the difference between good teams and great teams. And we were just an average team because we were not consistent in what we were doing. You know, anybody can be good on any given night. Can you be good on, you know, a Tuesday night in Charlotte when nobody's watching? You know, those are the great ones. The great ones are great 9 out of 10 nights, not 4 or 5. Out of 10 nights. You're great 9 or 10 out of 10 times. And it's really about being present in being where your feet are, you know, and valuing every moment that you're out there on that basketball court. But the consistency, sustained greatness is the hardest thing to have a team. And you see teams, you know, they have these moments and they have these runs, right? Like that Minnesota team, like, you know, the Patriots, like the Kansas City Chiefs, you know, like, and at some point, things start to shift and turn. But for us, I felt like this team had the potential to be one of our best teams ever that we had here in Vegas. I thought that potential was always there. Now I got to get everybody else to believe what I believe and get everybody on the same page. And like I said, to a point where everybody's in a safe place to grow and trust, because it's really about trust.
As I wanted to circle back a little bit to something you said as you talk about squeezing the rock and just how can, you know, starting to think now, like, how can we get better? I guess for a coach, because naturally if a player wants to get better at shooting, they're going to shoot a bunch, they're going to go into drills and things like that. How do you grow as a coach in the offseason? Like, what does the introspective part, what does that kind of look like for you?
I mean, for me, it's watching a lot of basketball that's not my team. I love learning from other coaches, other systems, just watching, evaluating. Even with the NBA side, I watch a lot of NBA basketball trends, what certain teams you see, you know, what's Oak City doing defensively that we can learn from and maybe add to our game, or, you know, the offensive rebound, I think, which you've hounded me on for the past 3 years. You know, we this last year, I was like, we're going to hit the offensive glass, and we got more offensive rebounds than probably we ever had in my previous 3 year total. Because we just made it a point of emphasis, and I thought it really paid dividends for us. Those are areas of growth, and it's changing. You know, we changed some of the defensive things that we were doing. So, and some of the stuff, you know, it didn't work. So I was like, okay, we're gonna go back to what we know works here, because you can have an idea and it can sound a certain way, and then maybe it just doesn't fit for your team. So it's also along with that team identity, and you have, you know, every year is different. It's like, what's going to work for this team this year? And how can we implement, you know, getting better as a unit, along with those individual, you know, people are getting shots up and individual development. My goal is always the group. What's best for our group? How can we get better as a group?
Okay. Like, I had a similar question along those lines. Like, how do you kind of balance, these are my core tenets, I want my teams to be this, versus evolving with the league or looking for different edges as teams try to scout you more?
Yeah, I think what you just said there, you know, what you want your team to look like, some of those things have nothing to do with X's and O's, Nikai. What I want my team to be is the most competitive team. I want them to be the most disciplined team. You know, those have nothing to do with X's and O's, but like, if you're talking characteristics, like, what does a Las Vegas Aces team look like? Man, we're the most competitive people on a possession by possession basis. We are disciplined, you know, when it's, we don't take the easy road. Like, we, not only do we not take the easy road, like, we seek out the hard road, which is the hardest, because the hardest is going to prepare us the best, you know? And I think those are, you know, tenets that, we're a selfless team. We play with a lot of unselfishness. Like, those are traits that I want when people look at us, that chemistry, that culture that people like, those are the non-basketball traits, you know, that don't have anything to do with X's and O's. You know, I tell them all the time, I can give you the why and the how, but, you know, you got to bring your reasons of every day why you want to step on this court with each other and what you're playing for. You know, but the competitive, the discipline, like, those are things that, the unselfishness, the joy, I think that our teams, you know, I really remember a distinct game when we went to, we made the change in the starting lineup, and we started KB, and we were in Dallas. And I got, that was the first time that year that I got so many, first of all, Nikias, nobody texts you when you're losing. Man, that phone is quiet when you're losing. The only person that will call me or text me during losing is Pop, because he knows how it's been. In fact, you know, nobody called him or texted him when they were losing, when things, you know, start. So he'll be the phone call when we're losing, or the text. But it was the first time in the year that, I got the text that, man, that, now that is the Aces team we're used to seeing. That is Aces basketball, where it was a lot of movement. Everybody's involved. There's a lot of joy. You're just playing the basketball the right way at the appropriate execution and standard and excellence that we demand night in and night out from our ladies. So, but that was kind of like a little bit of a turning point. And in our season, when I felt like that game, I'm like, okay, now, we've been pounding the X's and O's on the, we have to get these things done and we have to be consistent in these things. But it's where those other traits, we were competitive on a possession basis. We were unselfish on a possession by possession. It was those other things that I really felt and saw come to life during that, you know, 16 game stretch.
Got you. KB really had a good time against Dallas last year. I'm not sure what it was about the matchups that allowed her to pop in that degree. But those matchups,
I don't know. I was like, KB, pretend every team we play is Dallas, because she played her butt off. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes you just have, you know, those teams that you just love playing against. I guess Dallas was one of those teams for KB.
Got you. I want to shift to the offense. And this is something that I've talked to Steve and asked him about throughout the W season, just in general with basketball. Asia Wilson, best player in the league, one of the best players ever, if not the best player already. I think a common theme when talking about her and her greatness is how she's able to produce in spite of teams sending 2-3 defenders at her and seeing the amount of double teams that she sees. And I think one of the quiet shifts from the Aces as they go into that 16-0 run to close out the regular season is where Asia was getting her touches and putting her in the middle of the floor and putting her in different spots to where teams couldn't send that help. And so I wonder for you, I guess philosophically, like how much can an offense dictate how much a player gets double teamed?
I mean, offensively, you can only do what you can do. I can't. I mean, if a coach wants to send a double team in the middle of the floor, which is hard, you know, pick your poison. We're going to ask Asia to play the right way in those scenarios. Sending a double team on the block, obviously, just spatially gives a little bit more advantage to the defense. That's just more advantageous for them to kind of do it in those areas. So offensively, yeah, we wanted to put a lot of space around her where, A, it was very clear to see for her to see what was happening and where it was coming from. You know, a lot of times on the block, you can catch it and your back is to certain parts of the floor. And, you know, just getting her out of those situations where maybe she could get caught up or not see things. I wanted to be her to be able to see very clearly where people were coming from, who they were coming off, and then just kind of put her in those situations to where she felt good and we felt good about her just making reads out of it. And, you know, early on in the season, she was getting obviously double and triple teamed a lot. And it's really hard for a player of her stature to when maybe your teammates aren't knocking it down as at a high enough clip to where people get out of that defense, people get out of send of those double and triple teams. And I think Asia's willingness to continue to just trust her teammates and play the right way built a lot of, I would just say, trust in her. But if she's going to play the right way and you see her passing it out of a double team, everybody on this damn roster better be passing it when they see two people. I'll tell you that right now. So, you know, again, it was just about finding spots and putting her in space where we felt like she could be most efficient, but also see and feel where people were trying to come at her from.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned finding spots. And I think one of my favorite things about the evolution during this run is moving Asia around the board offensively. As far as we can get movement into a post up, we can get a stagger for Asia and have her turn the corner and finish. How important was that? And where did that open up for you offensively?
Well, really, we started running Asia a lot. We started running a lot of guard sets for her. We run her off pin downs and staggers, and it's really hard for bigs to just get through there. You switch a little on, you don't want to do that. The bigs struggle to get through those screens. So just constantly trying to, you know, find spots where we can get her an advantage, whether that's on the perimeter or in the block. She's a very good screener, and I'll tell you, Jewel is a very good screener. KP was a very good screener. So having those combinations of where she can screen and then get some screens, some basic screen, the screener actions, but maybe out of a little bit funkier sets, trying to disguise things a little bit more, are things that, you know, I look to do maybe on an ATO or a first play of the game, something that the defense hasn't seen. But really, one of our best plays was just Asia bringing it. I'm like, guards get out and run. She rebounds it. She don't need your help dribbling the ball up the court. She can do that. But really turning Asia into a playmaker for us and a distributor just as much as a scorer, and her willingness to do that and just be able to make the right play. But, you know, one of our best plays all year was just her bringing it. Like, we're better than, you know, a point per possession with her bringing it up. So, Asia touch, you know, and there's just got to be times where she just has to touch the ball. Close paint touches, great, because we know, and she's learned too, just how to, you know, when I first got here, I thought maybe she struggled with the length a little bit at times, and she's kind of figured it out. And you saw that even with Malanga one game, you know, I think some of it was Asia missing, but her length probably played a factor in that. And then you see Asia make an adjustment the next game, the length is not as much as a factor. And that just goes to Asia's work and her ability to adjust her game, but also just kind of put in that visual, okay, I know I can get to these spots against certain defenders. And she's really become really great at it. Doesn't matter who you put on her, mm-hmm. right? Like, she's just put a little on her, they're probably too little. Put a big on her, they're probably too slow. Put a tweener on her, she's bigger and badder athlete. Like, you know, she's an absolute nightmare for matchups defensively.
She's a cheat code. Actually, to bounce off of that, what has that collaboration been like the last few seasons? As we talk about moving her around the board, how much of that has been, I see this in you, I want to put you in these spots, versus Asia saying, hey, I think I can do more of this. Can I do more of this?
Yeah, I mean, if Asia says she wants to do more of anything, I'm down to hear. You know, like I said, my first 3 years, we didn't really prioritize the offensive boards, but getting her around the basket, her second jump is ridiculous. It's probably mm-hmm. just as fast as her first jump, which is very rare in a player. And so my idea for her was obviously the shooting a three. When I first came in, I don't know how many she had attempted before I came, maybe two or three in her career.
Not enough.
And she's still not shooting enough for me, but she's coming along with it. And she's now mixed that in the game. I mean, to sit here and when I first came in, she didn't shoot threes at all. And 4 years later, she's shooting it out of over a 40% clip is bonkers, is absolutely bonkers. But along with that, her dribbling skills, her passing skills, like, I just feel like the woman can do it all. So why aren't we going to let her do it all?
Mm. Yes, to that end, on the flip to the defense, because something I asked Asia about heading into the postseason, she led the W in switches this year, which is a little bit of a mm-hmm. departure from what she had done in years past defensively, and won multiple Defensive Player of the Year awards before that. So obviously she can do, to your point, a little bit of everything. With the switching in particular, how much of that was her idea versus you kind of dictating more of that with the game plan?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that dictated it a little bit more is, you know, we didn't have Plum this last year. So we had Jewel, which is a bigger defender. And so we just switched in general more. Mm-hmm. When Dana came in, you know, obviously we're not trying to switch Asian. Dana's pick and rolls more than likely. Mm-hmm. And it was similar with KP. You know, there were certain people that we'd allow KP to switch with. But mostly we wanted to try to keep KP on one of their perimeter players. We wanted to try to keep Dana on one of those perimeter players. With Jewel, we could switch it up a little bit more. I mean, she's just bigger and a really good defender. So we felt like, you know, we could just do more switching in general. So there was that aspect of it. But I'll tell you one at a certain point in the year, I had them start writing scouting reports. So some mm-hmm. of this was them also integrating that more into how they wanted to guard certain things. And I let them run with that. You know, at the end of the day, if I can have the greatest idea in the world, but if they don't believe in it or they can't execute it, it doesn't matter. What matters mm-hmm. is what we can execute and what they believe is will work. Perhaps just as much as anything, and the effort that they put behind it. And, you know, no offense to you guys, but it became a little bit like, I worked with men a lot, and it's a lot better if you just make it seem like it's their idea. They're a lot more likely to go along with it, even though you've been saying the same thing. So I kind of just let it be their idea, and we went along with it, and they executed the crap out of it. So, you know, they had some good stuff. They had some good stuff, and I agreed with them, you know, on 95% of it. And occasionally I'd be like, can't do that here because of this, this, and this. And mm-hmm. most of the time, you know, we came to a conclusion that we all agreed on with the scouting reports.
Got you. I guess related to that, how do you kind of balance, if you're going to switch this often moving forward, how do you kind of balance Asia being on the perimeter and being able to hang there versus wanting her near the basket to protect the rim and ultimately end possessions for you as a rebounder?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. Kind of depends on who we're playing, obviously. Personnel plays hugely into where you want her on the floor. Mm-hmm. So that can really fluctuate game to game, personnel to personnel. There's some things that I feel like we could implement and that I've seen some NBA teams doing this year is almost just like a one man bottom person of a zone. You know, you're just passing her off. She's just going to take that bottom corner person. So she's always kind of hanging around that rim area. That's something I've kind of like thrown around in my head a little bit, that we could do with her. But the bottom line is, she's the one player that, you know, can defend a point guard and defend Brittany Griner. And she's the only person that can do that and do it really well, to where there was times, you know, we played LA and we put her on Julie Alamon. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of let her play roamer off of her. And so now it's a little bit different because, you know, people are playing out of their, what they're not normally used to. We kind of play their personality against them, you know, their nature against them. We did that a little bit with Sloot in the finals. We played her nature. I'm like, if she wants to shoot it with no dribbles and not, or with no passes coming down, she's not going to do that. That's not who she is. She wants to create and distribute for people. She wants other people to touch the ball. So let's make her come down here and shoot 20 shots, you know, and if she hits them, she hits them, and we lose and we go home. But if she misses or she gets hesitant, now we're cooking with gas, you know? So sometimes the schemes come from playing them a little bit, you know, with their nature and what comes natural to them as well as what we think will work X's and O's wise.
How important, Coach, is it to have a level of versatility defensively, at least in your back pocket, to where, okay, we've trapped in pick and roll. Maybe it didn't work, but we know we could do this, or we can put a big on a guard. How important is that during the season?
It's hugely important. Versatility defensively, I like to have a fairly large toolbox defensively. Here's plan A. If plan A doesn't work, here's plan B and C. And I think the one thing that coaches can often get stubborn with is, no, this should work. It's like, well, it's not working tonight, so let's change it. And then we'll come back after the game. Instead of like taking this loss, let's make an adjustment. So let's make a switch. I'm very open to changing things if it's not working. Like the players don't like getting their head pounded on one play or one action. Neither do I. So we're going to change it. If we thought, okay, this ain't working, we're going to switch it up and we're going to do something else. But we have a broad toolbox, I would say, defensively. We got a lot of stuff in there that we can throw at people and at different times. So the other thing is our team really gets a kick out of it. You know, like they really buy into some of the stuff that we're trying to do. And we've been doing it long enough and the verbiage is there and the trust is there that they know, like, we can execute these things. Really in any kind of environment, which is rare. You know, we ran a box and one in triangle in the finals. We haven't really done that all year, but we had done it in past seasons. And so the main pieces knew and understood, and they talk and communicate enough that everybody kind of just got the concept and got the what we were trying to do. And I think anytime you're talking about a defensive scheme or a defensive tool or whatever, versatility, you always have to ask yourself as a coach, what you're willing to live with. What are we willing to live with? Mm-hmm. And if that beats you at some time or one night, so be it. But like, you're not going to be able to stop everything. It's why the score is not 12 to 14. You know, there's just, the offenses are too good. And I think steady doses of any one thing, you know, a lot of times it's just about mixing it up and making them think about doing something different offensively. Or not allowing certain players to get a beat on you. So, to me, I'd really like the creative side of the defensive game that we can do. And it obviously messes with players a lot of times with their head and stuff, because it's like, dang, you're going to leave me this open? Like, it's just like insulting just being right here. You're not guarding me. So, you know, there's a psychological part of it that goes into it as well.
Got you. Actually, just to hang there for a moment, I know I've asked you before who some of your influences are in terms of like drawing up the ATOs, as the Aces were the best like out of timeout team in the league this year. Defensively, are there any coaches or different leagues that you're watching to kind of get ideas on that front?
I always go back to Nick Nurse. I think he does some creative things. Oak City does some creative things. But Nick Nurse, I mean, I remember doing scouting reports. Portland was my scout. Toronto was my scout. But, like, I'm watching Toronto play Portland. I'm like, well, I'm rewinding. I'm like, these guys, they're playing CJ and Dame in a triangle in two. So it really, you know, which was unheard of in the NBA. Like, people did not do a lot of junk. Now you see a lot more zone. 1-3-1s, little traps here or there. Like, people are mixing up their defensive coverages a lot more and just being more creative, I would say, even with just matchups, you know, putting certain players on certain people. You know, it's something that Phoenix tried with us. You know, they switch their matchups frequently to try to take away different things. You know, and it's not, it hasn't been so traditional. Oh, you're the four, so you're the four, and I'm going to guard you. You know, I'm like, the fifth graders do that. They put the armband on the color, and then you guard your same color. You know, oh, you got the orange armband. I have an orange armband, so that means I'm your defender. It's just not like that anymore, and I think it's really brought a creative side out. On the defensive end, that's been really fun to watch and really learn from. But, you know, and then we even made some stuff up along the way. Like, you add your own little element into it based on the strengths of your team and maybe things that you want to take away from the other team. So I really like doing different things and being creative and just kind of thinking outside the box. And I love it that my players are starting to do the same. You know, they had some things, they had some scouting report things that were really outside the box. And my assistants were like, no, I'm like, I love it. This is great. And this is what, you know, so I think, you know, just in general, unleashing that creativity and giving them the freedom of thought that just because we've done it this way, don't mean we have to do it that way all the time. Now, like I said, there's some non-negotiable things that we have to have, like blocking out, like that's a non-negotiable, like we have to block out, trying to stay between our man and the basket as best we can. Like, those are things that are like basic basketball principles, you know, they're fundamentals for a reason. And so those things never change. We always have to be doing those things.
Got you. All right, I know we are running out of time. One question I wanted to ask you, from transitioning to a player to a coach, is there an area of basketball or a player archetype that you appreciate more now as a coach than you did as a player?
I don't know. I think, you know, I used to think I was like objective as a player, you know, like, oh, I think this. And every player thinks they're objective in thinking about their team. Mm-hmm. Like, we should be doing this. But it's just the color of glasses that we wear that it's like it's always going to kind of slant towards your favor or kind of what's best for you. Like, it's just that's just how it is. And I think when I became a coach, because like I said, I thought I was very objective as a player. Like, this makes a lot of sense. We should do it this way. But, you know, no player can be truly objective about what's best or what works best for the team. Until you're outside and you're responsible for every team member as a coach is. And I think, you know, I mean, I have a lot of appreciation for a lot of teammates because they all did different things. You know, Jane Appel used to set one mean screen. I used to love that. Ruth Riley used to set some mean screens for me. Used to hate playing against them and trying to run through those screens. but you know, those teammates that you have that like you kind of hate to play against, but you love them when they're your teammate. But no, it's just a really, I would say just, I wouldn't say I favor any one thing after another. What I favor, Nikias, is competitive people. I love competitors. I want competitors. I want you to compete and be present, be a predator, looking for every advantage constantly. Like, you're almost stalking people out there. Like, I'm waiting for my advantage to come, and I'm gonna create those advantages or ways to exploit you. I really love just competitive players. That's what I enjoy. I enjoy coaching that. I enjoy being around people like that. So just the most competitive ones, that's what I love. And I loved it as a player too.
Oh, there we go. Well, thank you, Coach, for your time. We really appreciate you hopping on. Actually, last quick one. Any more Miami trips planned for Unrivaled?
Yes, I'll be back down there probably a couple times. You know, it's hard to kind of go into these conversations once free agency starts on the 21st because we kind of don't have any base, but of what it's going to look like or what it's going to be. But just gauging people's interest and letting people know, you know, how interested we are in them. So I'm excited to get back down there and be able to have those conversations. But I'll be down at AU too. So I got, you know, I got to visit my squad a little bit, take the tours and see what's out there once we're able to talk to people. So.
All right. Understood. Well, thank you again for rocking with us. congratulations on the championship. I'll try to drum up some really good questions for you for this upcoming season.
Yeah, you know, about that ATO stuff, Nikias. This is also a very rare and elite skill set that my team has, is the ability to execute off the board. Mm-hmm. Not all teams have that, and so it's really a treat for me that I have that level of athlete that is able to do that. Because I've been on some teams that are great off the board, and other teams that are not. And I could tell you, this team, and pretty much all the teams I've had here in Vegas are unbelievable off the board. They can go out there, never see it, and understand the timing of it, what's going on, what's happening, and what we're looking for, and really execute it. So that's a shout out to my team for just being boss ladies in that category. They're exceptional in that area.
Got you. They deserve the shout. I appreciate it.
All the shouts.
A special thank you again to Becky Hammond for joining us. A thank you to you, Steve, for putting up with me and my nonsense, especially during the Most Improved conversation. And thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already to catch all of our awesome content. You can follow me on socials at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.